Something else to worry about. You might have seen a video appearing to show US House Speaker Nancy Pelosi drunkenly slurring her words. It was a fake. You can see it on our webpage. And it was quite easily done by slowing down a real clip of Pelosi and adjusting the pitch of her voice. But more complicated algorithmic techniques can depict people doing what they've never done, say things they've never said, say things they never would even dream of saying. Deep fakes, they're called. It's been said that they represent a paradigm shift in the truth decay of our times. Hani Farid is Professor of Computer Science at the University of California, Berkeley. He spent the last 20 years developing forensic technology to identify digital forgeries, and he's now working on new detection methods for deepfakes. He's working with US military's research agency, DARPA, on a program called Media Forensics, for example. And I asked him why they're called deepfakes.
They're actually called deepfakes because they are built on a technology called deep neural networks. So deep neural networks are being used to synthesize content. And so the deep has been derived from that term.
Now, fake news is not new. The worry is that it's the instant dissemination on social media of fake video and audio. Am I correct?
You're absolutely right that there's nothing new about fake news. There's nothing new about fake images, fake video. But what is new with the deep fake phenomenon is the democratization of access to technology that allows for the masses, not just the Hollywood studios, to create sophisticated and compelling fakes. And of course, you have to pair that with the reality of social media today, which is that the same people who can now create this content can distribute it to the world, to the millions and millions of people within hours. And in many ways, that's the new risk. It's not the phenomenon itself. It is the scale at which it cannot be deployed on society.
And how possible is that right now?
Well, here's what I can tell you. It's getting easier and easier. So if you look at the trends over the last 12 to 18 months, the technology to create the fakes is getting better and better. It's becoming more and more accessible. The fakes that we are seeing online are getting of higher and higher quality. And of course, everybody has for a long time had access to social media, and the social media companies have for the most part not done a very good job of content moderation. So I don't think it's a stretch of the imagination to say in the next year or 2 years, between the synthesis of text, images, audio, and video, it's going to become harder and harder to believe what we see and hear online. And I'll add that there's one, in some ways, larger threat here, because as we enter a world where computers can synthesize news stories and images and videos, suddenly nothing is real because everybody has plausible deniability. So any time a politician is caught saying or doing something that is embarrassing or illegal, they can simply say it's fake. And they will have plausible deniability. And in many ways, that may be the larger risk here, is that as we enter this new world where the computers can synthesize reality, reality just vanishes.
And so you get what somebody's called truth decay even more than we have now.
I think that's a great word. It scares me a little bit. Of course, the technology to create it is there. Of course, it's also the social media platforms. It's the increasing polarization of society. It is the financial incentives to create fake information, the political incentives, the ideological incentives, and they're all sort of coming together in a way that is in many ways the perfect storm, because all of the pieces are there now to really wreak havoc on our sense of reality online.
And this could be weaponized, of course, by politicians or activists by using disinformation to discredit.
Absolutely. And that's not hypothetical. We are seeing this in China right now with the Hong Kong protests. The Chinese government has gotten caught creating fake news stories, fake Twitter accounts, fake Facebook, fake YouTube to try to discredit the Hong Kong protesters. So these are not abstract threats.
How do we know that the videos that the Chinese government put out about the Hong Kong protests were in fact fake?
So I haven't seen these videos. So my understanding is that the folks at Twitter have deleted many, many accounts that they have linked back to the Chinese because of their use in disinformation. And so they have gotten caught with their hand in the cookie jar, as we say. And you know, so these the point of that is that these are not abstract threats. This is happening. It's happened in the Brexit campaign in the UK. It happened here in the US through our last national election. We've seen interference in Brazil. We've seen horrific violence in Myanmar and Sri Lanka and the Philippines and in India, all surrounded by fake news. And misinformation is also at a deeper level. It's ripped our societies apart. Because the nature of social media is that we live in echo chambers, because the social media companies are feeding you content to keep you on your platforms as long as possible. And so they are part of the problem of this polarization of society. And then, of course, they are feeding you fake news because that's good for engagement, which is good for profits. And so that is in many ways the perfect storm of what we are seeing. And it's not, frankly, just a technological issue. It's also a human issue. It's a corporate issue, and it's a legislative and regulatory issue.
You're suggesting that the social media companies are culpable in some way, but if it's not possible to tell the difference between real and fake, what can they do?
So first of all, in some cases, it is possible to tell the difference between real and fake, number one. And they just have not invested the resources, their vast resources, into doing so. Number two is there are other mechanisms other than telling the difference between real and fake to deal with fake news. So, for example, because the business model of YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter is that we are not the customer, we don't pay them, they have created a system where it's very easy to get on board, right? Just give them an email address and you're signed up. And so that means bots can create account after account after account. We call this a frictionless system. It is designed to have zero friction in the system so that they can maximize their user base, so they can maximize their advertising dollars. That is the underlying business practice of Silicon Valley and social media in particular. They could choose to have a different business model. They could choose to say that you have to validate an account with a mobile device or a credit card would create friction in the system and make it harder for people to automatically create accounts to the tune of thousands a day and spread disinformation. So there are other types of business practices that these companies could do that would discourage this type of abuse of their platforms, but they don't do it because it's bad for profits.
Meanwhile, you've been working on the forensic analysis of fake versus real. And you have, I mean, clearly you can't talk about all your work because it's a kind of an escalation of weaponry out there. But you have spoken about focusing on changes of color in a person based on heartbeat and presumably blood circulation and pulse. But isn't that easily faked in itself?
Anytime you develop a forensic technique, you have to be aware that there will be a countermeasure to that and you will counter to that and so on and so forth. So the way I think about these forensic techniques is that they do not eliminate the ability to create a fake. What it does is it takes it out of the hands of the average person. It makes it more difficult, more time-consuming, more risky to do it because you're more likely to get caught. So we develop not one technique, not two techniques, but dozens of techniques. Some of them look at relatively straightforward things like change in color, the quality of the video over time to see if it's been manipulated. But there are other aspects of what we do that look at behavioral patterns. How do people move their heads and their eyes and their mouth? How does the voice change as the head moves and so on and so forth, which tends to be fairly distinct per individual. And so each of these different techniques, and as you said at the beginning of the question, I won't tell you all of them, together start to make it more difficult but not impossible to create the forgery. So my job is to take out of the hands of the average person on the internet that's downloading some code and creating the deep fake, the ability to create fakes that will fool people. There will always be, well, people like me who can create compelling and sophisticated fakes. There will always be the Hollywood studios. But that, while it's still a risk, is a more manageable risk than millions and millions of people who can carpet bomb the internet with fake news and fake videos and fake images.
But there's always leakage, right? I mean, I think quite recently, researchers from the Max Planck Institute explained how they could make it much easier to dub language onto a movie. Well, mm-hmm. You pointed out that this could easily be weaponized. So should those things be done at all?
in some way, it's too late to ask the question because the cat is out of the bag. The technology is there. But I don't think it is too late to start talking about ethics in technology, and particularly in the academy and in industry. Because if we have reached an age, which I think we have, where technology, and we know this, can be weaponized, I think we now have a responsibility to start asking two questions. Should we be doing it? And if the answer is yes, then how do we mitigate the potential harm for the technology? Of course, biologists and physicists and other more mature scientists have thought about these ethical issues for a long time. I think because technology is relatively immature, because computer science is a relatively immature field, we've not had to contend with these issues the way we're contending with them today. But here we are. And I have been an advocate of academics, my friends and colleagues, to be thoughtful about the problems they choose to work on. And if they choose to say, we think the benefits outweigh the risks, that's fine. But then just be careful on how you deploy the technology. You can do research. You can do it responsibly. You can publish papers. You can make the public aware of it. But you don't have to give away the code. You don't have to give away the data. You don't have to literally hand a loaded gun to the average person on the internet in order to push the boundaries of science and technology. And I'm an advocate of just simply thinking through these issues before we rush into things, which frankly is why we are in the mess we are today with social media, because it has been very much the move fast and break things mindset, and not innovate, move slowly, and don't break things, which I think is the more responsible way to think.
You wrote a paper called Protecting World Leaders Against Deepfakes. You co-authored it with a number of other people, including Hao Lei, who's Professor of University of Southern California, CEO of a startup called Pinscreen, which makes virtual avatars. Isn't he part of the problem?
Yeah, of course. And I think he would say the same thing, too. I think he would say the same thing. Look, and I think he wrestles with these issues. Because, you know, look, what you have to understand about deepfakes is they're sort of new in the sense of sort of their level of sophistication. But for the last 20 or 30 years, people like Professor Lee developing technology to do exactly this. It's always been, however, that the technology was in the hands of Hollywood studios and maybe a handful of state-sponsored actors. And what happened very quickly over a period of a few years is because of advances in machine learning and big data, we suddenly had tools that were in the hands of the average persons with a laptop. And I think Professor Lee and I think people like him wrestle with these issues. And the reason we collaborate with him and the reason he collaborates with us is because he has the ability to create very sophisticated fakes. And that allows us then to build better forensic techniques. But you're right. It is sort of an odd friendship and an odd collaboration in some ways. But I don't think of it as adversarial at that academic level. I don't think that Professor Lee is setting out of global democracies. I think he is setting out to build cool technologies that have really interesting and useful applications in Hollywood and elsewhere. And then there's a dark side to that technology. I stand by what I said earlier. You should be thoughtful and careful about how you deploy. But I'm also an advocate of working with people like me on the forensic side to help us build better detection tools. That seems like a responsible thing to do.
So your collaboration is that he's making fakes and you're seeing if you can detect them and if so, how?
That's exactly right.
Sorry,
let me just add, we don't close the loop. We don't go back and say, okay, here's what you did wrong. You should make it better here, here, and here. We don't close the loop on that. It's a one-way street. They give us fakes. We build detection schemes to detect it. But they're not then going, turning around and trying to defeat our forensic techniques. Right? Because frankly, for non-nefarious purposes, there's no incentive to do that. If the fake looks good to the average person, that's what they're trying to accomplish. They don't have to defeat forensic techniques, and that's not their incentive.
They don't have to defeat forensic techniques because by the time you forensic guys get your trousers on, these things are all over the world. Is that what you mean?
Yes and no. I mean, no, what I mean by that is the goal of what Professor Lee is doing and people like him is to build avatars that are truly appealing to the average user. They don't have to build an avatar. So if it looks realistic to you, but I can detect it forensically, what do they care? Right? So it's where is the goal here? And the goal is to make something that looks cool, not something that can pass every single forensic technique. That's not, they're not actors. That's what bad actors would be doing. That's not what they are doing.
No. But you have to treat them as bad actors, don't you? Otherwise, what's the point in what you're doing? You're trying to, I'm guessing, perfect a technique in order to say, this is fake.
Sure. Sure. Absolutely. So to some degree, yes, we treat all people who synthesize as our adversary. That's certainly the case. But we should understand that there's sort of two categories in that space. And we should understand, too, that there are interesting and entertaining applications of deep fakes. Those are, if you will, our frenemies. Those are people that we can collaborate with. Yes, they're building synthesis techniques, but they are willing to work with us to build better and better forensic techniques. There are almost certainly bad actors who are honestly and genuinely trying to defeat forensic techniques. Those are not the types of people that we work with because their incentives are completely misaligned with ours.
Yeah, but the more you can learn about creating fakes and guessing that they are fakes, the more you can apply those techniques to the bad actors. Isn't that the aim of the exercise?
Absolutely. At the end of the day, you know, what we would like to be able to do is build tools that we will put in the hands of national security agencies, law enforcement, investigative journalists, who will help them vet content as it starts making its way around the internet so we can understand what's real and what's fake. That is the end game for us.
But eventually, these forensic techniques are just going to be useless because, I mean, as you point out in the paper, Protecting World Leaders Against Deep Fakes, it was pointed out that deep fakes, face swap deep fakes, didn't blink at the frequency you would expect a real person to blink. And so shortly after that technique was made public, the forensic technique, the next generation of synthesis techniques incorporated blinking, right?
Yes.
So there's no way through on the forensics. What else can we do?
I don't think that's quite accurate, and here's why. So think about spam and viruses and malware, right? So we've been fighting these for decades, and you could have made an argument 20 years ago, why fight? You're going to lose. But if you unilaterally disarm, then it's a one-way fight, and you're really going to be in bad shape. So by fighting and even losing, we are still winning multiple battles. If I can take out of the hands of the average person the ability to create the fake, I've actually done something. So the average person now, it is getting harder and harder to get spam through the filters. It is getting harder and harder to get viruses to the filters. Is this show a risk? Absolutely. Have we managed the risk? Sure, of course we have. And that's the same game with forensics. It will always be an evolving game. Forensic techniques that we develop today, 2, 3, 4 years from now, probably won't be as applicable as they are now. But that's okay because we will have developed new forensic techniques and we will continue to move the bar. We will continue to force the adversary to innovate and do better and better and better. They will do the same of us. And it is like any type of cybersecurity space is, yes, I will eventually lose. And there's something slightly demoralizing about that, but I will also win in the sense that I will have narrowed the space of people who can get away with this to an increasingly smaller and smaller space. And that's, in the end, probably the best I can do.
Gosh, I mean, I thought that you would have more faith in technology being able to up the ante on this constantly.
Yeah. Here's the thing. Playing defense is hard. So think about the spam game. So how does spam work? They send out billions and billions of spam messages. 1% gets through, 0.1%. That works. So playing offense is easy because you can carpet bomb the place and eventually something is going to get through. With defense, you have 0% tolerance. You have to catch everything. And so fundamentally in this space, playing defense is really, really hard because offense has at its disposal volume. Just keep doing it until one gets through. One is always going to get through. And that's okay though, because if I make it so that 0.01% of spam gets through, I can manage that. If it was 10% of spam getting through, I can't manage that. And so by even narrowing, always narrowing the pipe, if you will, we start to have success.
There's a San Diego-based startup called TruePic, which is developing image verification technology. I think you've got a stake in that. Is that the way we're going, that there needs to be some kind of complicated stamp on everything to make it verifiable? Yeah.
So let me clarify. I do have a stake in the company, a financial stake. So I just want to clear about the potential conflict of interest here. But you're absolutely right. The way TruePIC works is what we have been talking about is what we call passive forensics. I wait for an image or a video to show up on my desk, and then I do an analysis to try to determine if it's real or not. The way TruePIC works is it works at the point of capture. I call this an active forensics. So what it does is when you push the button using their camera app to record an image, an audio, or a video, exactly at the point that you push that button, it reaches into the content that you have recorded. It extracts a unique digital signature, cryptographically signs that, and puts it onto the blockchain. And the only thing you have to know about the blockchain is that it is what is called a distributed immutable ledger. So distributed means that the information is stored on millions of computers around the world, and immutable, of course, means that you can't change it once it's been on there. That signature is now fixed. And you can now look at the content at any point in the future after capture. You compare the signature to what's on the blockchain, and you can authenticate. That technology works at scale. Nothing else does today. It is the one technology that we actually could deploy. And if it was in every single camera device in the world, the 10 billion some odd devices in the world, we would to trust content a lot more. I think we will, I don't know if we will get to 10 billion devices, but I think we will eventually get to a place where the iPhones and the Androids and the Samsungs of the world start to incorporate this type of technology into their devices so that people have the ability to say, this is a trusted image, a trusted video, and we will even start rewarding that over untrusted content because we want to start valuing trusted information so we can understand what's going on in the world. I like this technology a lot. It's actually relatively straightforward. You know, it's not perfect. There are defenses you have to make sure that you don't get attacked, of course, like with anything in cybersecurity. But it is something that works at scale today. And I'm a strong advocate of the camera devices and the social media companies starting to incorporate this into their systems so that we can start to get a handle on the fake news phenomenon that is wreaking havoc on society.
That Skype connection is deteriorating terribly. Let us transfer to the phone. Now, the U.S. House Intelligence Committee has asked Facebook, Google, and Twitter how they plan to deal with deepfakes. What was their response?
The most common response I've heard from the technology sector is AI got us into this problem, and AI will get us out of this problem. I think that's a spectacularly naive view of where AI is and where it is going. What the technology platforms will want you to believe is that they can automate the process of content moderation. And it is simply not true. It's not true today. It won't be true tomorrow, and it won't be true for years from now. They need to start investing in more human moderation. They need to start investing in technology, and they need to start investing in changes in the underlying business model to deal with this issue. AI is not going to solve the issue tomorrow. And when Mark Zuckerberg was pushed on when, he said, I don't know, 5 years, 10 years. And my answer to that is, well, what would you like me to do in the intervening decade while you try to get your act together? This is an unacceptable answer. And so my view of these things is that these platforms have built something at a scale that is unprecedented. They have built it in a way that is creating havoc for society, and they are now turning around and saying it is too big. It is simply too big for us to do anything about it. And I have a few thoughts on that. One is, they don't seem to have any trouble making billions and billions of dollars on the size of their network. They monetize big data to tremendous effect. So why do they get so dumb when it comes to content moderation, number one? And number two is, you built it, you have to fix it. You can't build a monstrosity like this and say, well, I can't manage it now. You have to find a way to fix the problem that you created. And if you cannot, well, then it is beholden on our legislators to start putting in regulatory constraints and start, as the Germans have, as the EU has, as the British have, start putting serious constraints on these platforms and get them to wake up. The Germans have been very aggressive in dealing with content moderation to the tune of upwards of 50 million euros for each violation. While 50 million euros is not a lot for Facebook, if they get slapped with that fine day in and day out, that is going to get somebody's attention. And then the last thing I'll add is that the real change here can't come from us, the consumer. Because at the end of the day, we're not customers. We're the product. Where change has to come from is where all the revenue is, and that's advertisers. There are 20 CEOs in the world who are spending billions and billions of dollars on these platforms advertising, which is what is fueling Silicon Valley, and they could turn around tomorrow and say, enough.
We have had enough of the mess that is social media. We are simply going to stop advertising on your platforms until you can clean it up. And when you do, come talk to us and we will look at it again. Watch how fast these platforms get smart and watch how fast they get good at content moderation. There are 20 people in the world that can change this, and they should.
I read a fascinating article about you in The New Yorker, which said that back in 2011, you essentially recreated a car's license plate that was indecipherable to try mm-hmm. to track down a murderer mm-hmm. by means of image synthesis, computer graphics, AI, machine learning, yeah. effectively.
Yeah. yeah.
So what you're doing now is the reverse of that. Is that kind of right?
Yeah, I mean, look, there's no doubt that the advances in machine learning, AI, big data, image synthesis has tremendous applications. We have used it forensically to solve and work on a murder case, as you mentioned. But there is a dark side to the technology. And as a technologist, you know, my job is, of course, to push the frontiers of technology, to take advantage of the many wonderful things that come from technology, the breakthroughs in our lives and society. But we can't ignore the dark side. We have to pay attention to how technology is being misused, and we have to come to grips with that and find ways to safeguard it. So all of these technologies are double-edged swords. They can be used for good, and they can be used for bad. That's always been true and will probably always be true. And I'm simply an advocate of the technology sector, academics, policymakers, and the public thinking about both sides of that sword and trying to get the best out of technology while mitigating the harms that we've been seeing.
Yeah, yeah. No, I wasn't accusing you of being a villain, but what interested me was that by means of getting huge numbers of digital photographs of license plates, you were able to rebuild the license plate by means of machine learning. But while we're talking about deep fakes, how do you know that the license plate or the letters or the numbers in the license plate that you were able to come up with were in fact not fake?
Right. So just by way of background, the way we had this very grainy, low resolution license plate. It was maybe 20 pixels in width, and you couldn't read anything. And we used similar technologies to what was being used to create deepfakes and image synthesis to try to figure out, to interpret what they were. Now, of course, the results in and of themselves, like in any criminal investigations, don't stand alone. You don't go to court and say, we found the bad guy because the computer said so. We identified three digits of the license plate. That went over to the detectives. They cross-compared that with the driver motor vehicle reports. They found a couple of cars that matched. They talked to those people, and then they started putting the pieces together with other evidence. So this was more of, if you will, the lead that eventually led to finding who was, we don't know yet because the case is ongoing, but most likely responsible. But of course, you have to be exceedingly cautious on how you use these forensic techniques. But in my experience in the courts, the forensic techniques rarely stand alone. They are part of a larger puzzle, an investigative puzzle that comes together.
I understand. Thank you. And one of the points you make is in terms of people being aware of what might be fake and what might be not, is beware of sharks.
This is the one advice I like to give, particularly young people. I've been doing this for a long time, and I don't know what it is about sharks, but people love making fake images of sharks. And I swear to you, I have come to doubt whether sharks even exist anymore, if they're even real, because every time I see an image of a shark, it's almost always fake. So this is my favorite piece of advice of everybody, is beware of fake sharks.
And that was Professor Hani Farid, who is at the University of California, Berkeley.